research is not a belief system.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is June 7th, 2011, and this is episode 511. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always get to make the mainstream news, the kinds of things that are frequently labeled as alternative or paranormal. For the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. You can also send it through the virtual auditorium on PalPoc via text. I do monitor the email during the program, so if you're listening outside of the virtual auditorium and would like to have a question answered, you can go ahead and email it to me and I'll get it asked for you. In the virtual auditorium, just put it in text. I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. And if I don't catch it the first time, feel free to repeat it again. For those of you who are listening in on a podcast, you can go ahead and email me as well. I will try to get your questions answered for you, too. If you would like to call in on the telephone and ask your question over the air, you may call us at 504-273-7379. That number is our call-in number, and once again, it's 504-273-7379. For those of you who like to feel connected, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter, so you can link to me there. There's also a Dawn of Shades fan page on Facebook, so you can look for that, too. For the readers, campers, and foodies, you can check out the articles and blogs. I'm sure you'll find something that just might interest you. Now, tonight, our guest is an author. His name is Len Kasten, and he is the author of The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, Advanced Technology in the Coming New Race. Len, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, I'm Len Kasten, and I am indeed the author of that book. Prior to writing the book, I had written 52 articles for Atlantis Rising magazine over a period of 14 years, most of which were on the subject of UFOs and ETs. And what we did was we put 26 of those articles together into the book, and we found that it was not just a simple compendium, but it had a strong narrative drive, and everything seemed to follow very well. And that became the book. The book has been very well received. It has now moved up to number 18 on the top 50 of the publisher, which is Bear & Company, Inner Traditions. And so it's doing quite well. I've done about 20 interviews, I think maybe perhaps more than that, including Coast to Coast, and as I said, the reception seems to be good, and we're getting very good reviews.
Good. Well, I have to admit, I didn't get the entire book read, but I did read a good portion of it, and it is a fascinating little book, and it covers a lot of the history, and sort of puts it together in a way that kind of connects it all. You know, what made you decide to write the book?
Well, as I said, the articles were written over a 14-year period, and they became the book. So I've been really been following the UFO-ET phenomenon for that period of time, and even before that, when I was a member of NICAP and MUFON and in Washington, and I had my own experience way back when I was in the Air Force, which really I think is what precipitated my entire lifelong interest. So,
what kind of experience did you have?
Well, I was in the Air Force down near the Gulf Coast of Mexico, near the Gulf of Mexico, and I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning in my barracks room and ran to the window for some reason to look out. And no sooner did I do that, I saw this craft go right by, glowing gold and green, phosphorescent. Couldn't have been more than 1,000 feet away, and it was coming from the runway part of the base. And I watched it go out over the Gulf of Mexico. So the next morning, the tower operators came in and said they had 4 UFOs on the radar that night. And I said, well, I think I saw one of those. I didn't even know what a UFO was at that time. They said, well, go report it to the UFO office, which I did. I found the UFO office, and there was a captain sitting there with a multi-page questionnaire, and he didn't seem to show very much surprise when I told him that the craft was going, I thought, about at least 15,000 miles an hour, because we judged it from the time I first saw it and the time it disappeared, and estimated how much distance it had covered. And he wasn't surprised at that speed, and that made me think, well, there have been quite a few other reports then, probably. But then what seemed to solidify the fact that I did indeed have a sighting was that the next day I came down with a very severe flu-like symptoms. And I was in the base hospital for 3 days. And I later learned that people who were taking on board the craft do seem to get sick like that frequently. So putting it all together in retrospect, apparently I was taken on board or abducted, whatever you want to call it, and some information of some sort was probably downloaded into my mind. But I didn't really, the effects didn't really manifest until about 3 years later when I was working in Washington for IBM in Washington, D.C., and that's when I joined NICAP. And that was the beginning of the whole thing.
So I had a question from the virtual auditorium, and that was about the UFO office on the base. I guess I'd never heard of such an office. Do they have typically an office like that, or did at that time?
In retrospect, I now understand that that was a Project Blue Book office. That was the time that they were gathering information from every single Air Force base in the country on UFOs because of Project Blue Book. So that experience that was the paperwork that was filled out went into that database, and it's somewhere in there, buried in there somewhere, even today, I'm sure.
Yeah. And then, you said you didn't really realize the effects until 3 years later. What kind of effects did you realize then?
Well, the main effect was that I found myself very much interested in metaphysics after I got out of the Air Force. And when I moved to Virginia Beach, or Richmond, actually, I haunted the New Age Library at the Edgar Cayce Foundation. And I was there very frequently, and I really acquired a self-education in metaphysics. Now, thinking about that, I'd already had a college degree in liberal arts, so what motivated me in that direction, I can only think that it was perhaps that experience in the Air Force. And that would make sense. Mm-hmm. That could trigger that kind of interest.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I joined NICAP and then MUFON and eventually started writing UFO articles for Atlantis Rising magazine.
So have you had any other experiences since then, or was that like a once-in-a-lifetime thing for you?
Well, evidently that was potent enough. I don't think I needed anything else. Whatever happened, it convinced me. It certainly convinced me, so that's all I needed, I guess. One of these days I will get hypnotized and find out, but I haven't really bothered to do that until now.
Yeah, well, I have to admit, the hypnotism, I wonder, you know, does that really help a person recover memories, or are there better methods to recover blocked memories than hypnotism? So, you know, I explore all the avenues with that myself, because, you know, there is some curiosity. And then there's also the issues about hypnotism itself. Some people claim that, you know, you're going to have false memories and, you know, all that, you know, and so you kind of go, oh, I don't know. So, yeah, I haven't made up my mind one way or another yet. And it probably will depend on having someone that I feel would be able to do a good job.
Well, I think if you read Dr. Mack's book, Abduction, and you read Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time, both of whom relied heavily on hypnosis to get to the truth, I think you'll find that the consistency in both books of reported experiences is so remarkably similar that for anybody to be making this up would be almost impossible. They couldn't possibly all be telling the same story, and they don't even know each other.
Yeah, you know, definitely. No, I don't discount hypnotic regressions entirely at all. I just, you know, question whether or not that's the best route for me. I guess it's probably a better. For one thing, I live in Mississippi. It's not like we have a great deal of UFO and abduction investigation stuff going on in the state. It's very, very conservative. A lot of people aren't even comfortable with the topic. So, you know, I can honestly say that
I don't think the aliens are particularly concerned with politics. So I don't think.
No, the UFOs folks aren't. But as far as general, there aren't any hypnotists that I'm aware of that do regressions for abductees in Mississippi.
Yeah, that may be so. I think there are some down in Florida, but I'm not sure about Mississippi.
Yeah, Mississippi doesn't. I mean, we don't even have a state director for MUFON.
Oh.
It doesn't have a whole lot going on.
I think there's a lot going on in Georgia, a lot in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area.
Atlanta's is a big city compared to combining probably all of the cities in Mississippi. And we're notoriously conservative here in Mississippi. I've only lived here not quite a year, and I periodically get surprised as far as how people react to some ideas and whatnot, because it is so conservative. You might say it's the heart of the Bible Belt in a lot of ways.
Maybe it may be so.
Some
but
ideas find.
Yeah, I think
yeah,
that the alien, the abduction phenomenon doesn't really show any boundaries anywhere. I think it's pretty uniform.
No,
for us.
there have been some quite well known cases that came out of Mississippi.
That's right.
So it doesn't affect the aliens the same way it affects the human population, you might say,
right,
as far as the region we live in. Even the United States in general seems to be much more less open to talking about it, to having it portrayed on mainstream media and whatnot in a non-humorous way, because they'll willingly portray it as a joke. But then Europe, and in many other countries, because, you know, they take it serious. And they don't poke as much fun at it as we do here in the United States.
Right.
Here in the United States, you're apt to see every hoax hit the mainstream news, but not a single real case will hit the mainstream news.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's changing, though, rapidly. And
that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Because, you know, whether it's aliens from outer space or something else, this is a very real phenomenon and needs very real attention, I believe.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, the other countries have already released their files. England already released its UFO files. Brazil released its UFO files. France released its UFO files. It's going all over the world now. Even Russia, I believe, has released a lot of UFO information. So we're like the last holdout here. And apparently, their whole
deeply wrapped in conspiracies and theories, and yeah, I mean, Roswell's 60 years old, and despite all the attention on Roswell, will we ever get the truth?
Well, if you read the books, the right books, you will get the truth. The truth is out there, and you just have to know where to go to get it.
Yeah, and I've read some very good books on it, and it's a case of the official government story. You know, even in my lifetime, I've seen it change. You know, how can the official real story change if it was ever the real story, right?
Well, they've tried this crash dummies thing. They've tried disfigured Japanese prisoners of war. Anything but to indicate that they were actually aliens. And it gets ludicrous, gets ridiculous, and anyone with any sense can see right through the fact that the Air Force keeps changing its story over and over again to accommodate the skepticism, and none of it's working. So, you know, the truth is out there. That there are some good books by Stanton Friedman and Don Schmidt that really do cover the subject quite well.
Yeah. What I found fascinating was the stuff that you had about the Hitler connection to extraterrestrials in your book. You want to talk a little bit about that for the audience?
Well, you know, there was always no question in my mind that the whole fascist movement was too coincidental to be an accident. The fact that all of a sudden Japan takes over the seas with an imperial navy and Hitler takes over the land with his blitzkrieg, you know, and Mussolini's, and they're all wearing black shirts and they're all, you know, the whole movement was uniform throughout the world, and all of a sudden I began to understand that there was an alien connection, and the deeper I dug, I found out that Hitler had indeed made a deal with the gray aliens in 1933. In exchange for their technology. So it all came down to a very, very strange coincidence. And then, as I did more and more research about Hitler's army, the so-called stormtroopers, and realized that where did they come from? After World War I, Germany was limited to only 100,000 men. And they were all old, dispirited guys who had fought in World War I and some raw young guys. Where do you get this bright young army of a million men in 1 year? And when I understood that Hitler had indeed made a deal with the aliens and that I knew the aliens had perfected cloning, I came to the conclusion, and others have agreed now, that perhaps that whole 1 million-man army that just appeared overnight in 1934, that stood at attention at Nuremberg in 1934, where did they come from? Could very well have been given to him by the aliens as a cloned army. And the more deeper I looked into it, the whole situation came down to what was really a extraterrestrial warfare, that it was an attempt to take over the planet and literally to enslave the planet, and that Hitler himself was simply a pawn, as was Hirohito and Mussolini, and they were all being used by the ETs. So that's the conclusion I came to, and that takes up two chapters in the book. Some of it sounds rather far-fetched, but I think if you read the book and you look at my logic, you may be inclined to agree with me.
A question from the virtual auditorium was, how did you find out about the deal between Hitler and the Greys?
You know, there's a lot of material out about that. The big clue, of course, was the fact that Hitler had flying saucers in 1939. Actually, earlier, they had flying saucers in 1937, the technology using electromagnetic energy to power these craft. He was very close to getting the atom bomb before we even got close to it. He had incredible weaponry that they called wonder weapons. And it turned out that this technology was not developed by his scientists at all. In fact, others have come to the same conclusion, that the technology was given to them. And they were sort of allied with the extraterrestrials in this whole drama. It was an alliance.
Now, you also talked about how the Nazis had a base in Antarctica. Has any sign of this base been found post-World War II?
The base was called New Schwabenland, and Hitler started developing that base in 1938, well before World War II broke out. In fact, it was a year before he invaded Poland. They had already found a way into under the ice in Antarctica to warm water lakes, and they had developed submarine bases down there, so-called Rainbow Lakes, under the Antarctic ice. And then they started dropping swastikas all over the surface to lay claim to that part of Antarctica. And then there's plenty of evidence that as they began to lose the war, they started moving men and materials to that base, so that by the time the war was over, they had already built that whole base up to very significant proportions. And there are many books on the subject. In fact, there are even videos out there of that. So I don't think there's any further doubt about it. So the question, of course...
Yeah, I'm just curious, what happened to all those men after the war was over? You know,
a lot of people think Hitler actually...
Why did Hitler commit suicide going there?
What's that again? Say that again, I'm sorry.
Why would Hitler commit suicide instead of going to his base in Antarctica?
Well, I came to the conclusion that he didn't commit suicide, and I'm pretty sure I'm right. Hitler had many doubles, people that looked just like him. The person they found burned at the bunker, the dental records did not match Hitler's, and Stalin found that out. And when he met with Roosevelt and Churchill, Casablanca, I think it was, or after the war, he told Roosevelt that Hitler was not dead. So evidently he found out the truth, and my own feeling is that Hitler escaped probably a day before the Russians got there, and was flown to Norway and was taken on a submarine from Norway to Antarctica or Argentina. It could have been Argentina because the Perón regime was very tightly controlled by the Nazis also. And that's another interesting facet, that Argentina was very close to Antarctica, so I don't think that was an accident either.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think Hitler did. I don't think Hitler did commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. Now, would his girlfriend or wife or whatever she was, and his children have gone also, or just Hitler himself?
The reported incident of a couple of soldiers who were at the airfield, who they saw him with Eva Braun getting on a plane the day he was supposed to have committed suicide. They saw him standing there arguing with one of his generals and then getting on the plane with Eva Braun.
Oh.
He didn't have any children of his own, so it was just the two of them.
Okay, I thought he had children for some reason. Okay. Now, another question that came up in the virtual auditorium was about Hitler's mentor in his early years. I know you talked a little bit about in the book. You want to talk, a little bit about that now?
About Dietrich Eckart?
Yeah.
Dietrich Eckart was his occult mentor. On his deathbed, he said, Hitler will dance, but it is I who have called the tune. I shall have influenced German history more than any other man in history. So he already knew. He said, I have given him the ability to contact the, at that time he called them the secret chiefs or the, but in any case he was referring to extraterrestrials. And, Hitler's entire occult education was given to him by Eckhart. Who was a disciple of Aleister Crowley. Many of your listeners may know about Aleister Crowley.
Probably. He's a fairly well-known guy, probably almost as well-known as Hitler. Now, all of this connection with E.T. and, between Hitler, Mussolini, and Haruhito, logic says E.T. had us way outclassed in terms of technology. And with all the technology they had at their disposal, how did the Allies even dream of winning, let alone actually cut it off?
The answer to that is obvious. We had some help, too. we did indeed have help. And if you read the book, you'll see that this conflict between the so-called reptilian gray race and the humanoid, or what's now called the Pleiadian and Andromedan race, is a very ancient conflict in this galaxy. And we were getting help too. Roosevelt was getting help too. And my conclusion is that we had Pleiadian representatives at the Pentagon for the entire war. And now, there's no question whatsoever that Nikola Tesla had a lot to do with our victory, because his development of radar is what saved England. The patents that we used that were installed in England and what resulted in them winning the Battle of Britain were all based on Tesla's technology. He was also working with Roosevelt in many areas. So really, while they had the aliens, we had Tesla. And I think we had more talent on our side with one man than they had with all the help they were getting. Because Tesla was unbelievable. He was really way, way beyond anyone else around here.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to look at history and actually consider aliens having had some input into it. And, you know, there's also talk about Roosevelt made an agreement with, or made or refused an agreement, because I've heard both stories over the years, with aliens, and I've heard a conflict in where this meeting took place. There are actually a variety of locations, ranging from, you know, in the ocean to various places in the United States to even overseas. Did you find anything to document a potential meeting between Roosevelt and aliens?
My understanding is that Roosevelt met Tesla in 1917 and was very impressed with him. When he was Secretary of the Navy, he realized Tesla's genius, and they became friends. So that by the time that Roosevelt became the president, he was very close to Tesla. And my understanding is that it was Tesla who set up the meeting. Tesla used to talk about his off-planet friends all the time. Anyone who was around him knew about that. And he himself could have been indeed an ET himself. In any case, it's believed that he set up the meeting between Roosevelt and the Pleiadians in the mid-Atlantic somewhere in the late 30s. That's all I can tell you. I don't have any more information than that. And that sounds reasonable, because Roosevelt already knew him well, even way before he became the president, so that he would have trusted his judgment and probably would have gone along with his advice. And I think that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. So, how... I kind of, you know, the Tesla and alien connection, I mean, you know, that could potentially be very, very true. Whether he was actually alien himself or not, it would explain a lot of the things. I mean, Tesla's even been blamed for the Tunguska event in Siberia, where the official scientific explanation is that it was an incoming comet that exploded before impact.
Right.
You know, that was devastating. That, you could read a newspaper in Paris, you know, at midnight. Okay, that's a bright light. That's a bright, bright light. And, you know, do you think Tesla was blamed for that?
I don't know. I really don't know the story on Tunguska. I do think it might have been a meteorite. I don't know how. Are you saying that some people think that Tesla created an explosion in the middle of Russia?
Yeah, that he was doing some sort of an experiment, and actually it was connected to the current heart project. Did some sort of an electric sort of experiment with his broadcasting electricity project, and it went wrong, and there was an explosion over, I'm thinking it was about 1917, 1919, right in there, over a region called Tunguska in Siberia.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, because he was doing all that way out stuff, and his experiments in broadcasting electricity really were working, and the powers that be in America were not very pleased with that, and I don't think he got the patents he was looking for, but I know he was connected. I know he was connected with the Philadelphia experiment. I'm not sure about Tunguska. It seems strange that he would be in the middle of Russia in 1919. I don't even know what he was doing.
Well, I don't think he was supposed to have been there. And I don't know how, you know, I don't know if he's conducting his experiment in Alaska, perhaps. I don't know how, you know, why it occurred there versus Canada or United States or someplace else. But that's been a steady side theory, you might say, about that particular event.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. It sounds like
the podcasting of electricity fascinating. Anyhow, I live in hurricane country. You know, we lose power all the time due to the power lines going down with the wind and everything. And so if it was broadcast, it'd be so much simpler.
Well, if you read Thomas Bearden's book about broadcasting through the vacuum, you know, the vacuum is, what they call the vacuum, is loaded with incredible energy. And it's the only explanation for how stars put out all this energy. Where are they getting it from? They're all floating in a sea of energy. And that means that perhaps that energy can be broadcast through that medium, which we think of as a vacuum, but it really is not a vacuum at all. So I think Tesla knew that, and he was involved with a lot of experiments involving getting energy out of the vacuum and broadcasting electricity through what people considered the vacuum, when it really was a medium of some sort.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
that's really how the flying saucers work. They extract energy from when they're in space. They extract energy from what's considered the vacuum. So it's crazy to think of it as a vacuum.
Now, you also talk about Adamski, I guess, Adamski, however you want to pronounce his name. I've heard it all sorts of different ways. But anyhow, you talk about him early on in your book, and a lot of people regard him as kind of whacked, as a sort of demented and eccentric character early in the history of ufology. You know, he had some very valid things to say and that took place. What originally caught your interest about him?
Well, I think that what happened was in the 50s, the U.S. government had already made a decision to stonewall the contactees and the UFOs that were appearing all over the country in the 50s. There were many, many people who were having experiences with UFOs in the 50s. They weren't UFOs. They were actual alien encounters with a race of entities who looked just like us. And Adamski was one of them. Howard Menger was another one. George Van Tassel. And they used to all gather at Giant Rock in the California desert in the 50s, and there used to be thousands of people who flocked there, and a lot of them claimed to have had encounters with human-looking aliens, and to be channeling those entities. And by the way, that term channeling, that's where it began, was in the 50s. Adamski was the main one, and his first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, covered his experiences very, very well. And that article that I wrote for my book was taken from from a single chapter in his book. And that chapter was called The Memorable November 20th, in which he actually had an encounter with an alien in the desert in California. And there's a lot of things in that story that are very, very convincing, including the fact that, according to Project Blue Book, a saucer was seen at that exact spot on that exact day. And that's in my book, too. But Adamski was a very sincere guy, and he had his telescope set up on Mount Palomar, and he was scanning the skies constantly, waiting for a contact. And he believed, eventually began to understand that he was getting telepathic contact. And that's why he went to that spot on that day, November the 20th, 1954, and had that experience. So I think he was sincere. I know he's had a lot of detractors, and I know that a lot of people have tried to convince everyone that he was crazy. But on the other hand, many books have been written by friends of his who testify to the fact that he was indeed very, very sincere in telling the truth.
When I read about him and whatnot, I get the impression that he became nearly fanatical about trying to maintain contact with extraterrestrials. And, you know, having known a number of other experiencers over the years and stuff, I can see where that fanatical desire to maintain contact would and could be the result of the initial contact with ET.
Absolutely.
You know, and so really his only sign of being unstable or whatever would be that obsession. And, you know, it's kind of a not surprising result, I suppose.
Especially not at all.
If the contact is perceived
likely,
as being a higher being.
Exactly. And I think that Spielberg was trying to get that whole concept across in Close Encounters by the character played by Dreyfuss, who became totally obsessed to the point where he was building mountains in his living room made out of potatoes, you know? And So Spielberg understood that, I think, and tried to portray that in that particular character. It can become obsessive, absolutely. I think you're right. I think Adamski was indeed obsessed.
Now, you know, in all your research about various people and in preparation for writing your articles and ultimately this book, was there a particular point that you perceive as sort of a turning point in human history in regards to extraterrestrials?
Turning point in what way?
In perhaps our attitude or our interaction, or even, you know, public perception.
Well, you know, public perception is a strange thing to even think about if you're talking about prehistoric times and ancient times. There's no question in my mind that von Daniken is absolutely right. They have been visiting us for thousands of years. Just look at some of these old archaeological sites and those huge, huge boulders that no humans could have moved physically. Have you been watching that show, Ancient Aliens, with Georgi Tsoukalos? Have you heard of that show?
I've seen some of the episodes, and I am familiar with Georgi Tsoukalos as well as von Daniken. I would actually have to blame von Daniken for my deep interest in both archaeology and extraterrestrial paranormal, all that connection. Of all the people in the world, were the first books that I came into contact with as a teenager that really caught my interest in terms of ancient aliens.
Right, yeah, that's interesting, yeah. Yeah, he was the first one, really. Chariots of the Gods was an incredible, incredible breakthrough. And it's still selling very, very, very well, even now.
Well, it's still a very relevant and interesting book.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I've read it hundreds of times. It still was a great afternoon read, you know?
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah,
he's a great guy. I really admire him. I really admire him even more than Sitchin, although Sitchin's work is remarkable also. And he really filled in a lot of the gaps, Sitchin did.
It is. You know, when we look at the various people who have come forward writing things, some people have been around a long time, like Von Daniken and Stanton Friedman and so forth. These guys have been around a long time. Is there somebody that really, in terms of our modern history and connection with E.T., that you would say even predated Adamski?
Well, Adamski was part of that whole movement, the so-called contactee movement of the 50s. I think that George Van Tassel, who built the Integraton in, out in the desert there, and Howard Menger, I think those three were the three main ones. But there were others. Because I think that the humanoid ETs had made a very determined effort in the 50s to make contact, and then they were shut out by our government, and they just had to go and basically contact people, individuals who they thought might spread the word through writings or appearances on television shows or radio shows. And I think that's what happened in the 50s. But they, the government really had set up a huge wall against belief in those things and discouraged anybody from believing that any of it was true.
Well, you know, when you look at it, there's been a steady disinformation sort of stream paralleling it to really make people question the sanity of anyone who did show anything about extraterrestrials, spacecraft, et cetera, as being real.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they tried to make it look like a nut.
Well, that was deliberate.
It'd be better to come out as a nut.
That was deliberate, yeah. They introduced the whole concept of the little green men, and they would laugh and snicker, and, of course, you got to be crazy to believe in that stuff. Yeah. No, that definitely was part of their program. No question about it.
Now, with your own experience, when you were sent to the UFO office, did you have that sort of reaction from within the military?
That guy was dead serious. He was asking me all the right questions. He had a multi-page form with very detailed questions for me. Where did you first see it? Where did it disappear? What speed would you estimate it? What did it look like? What were the colors? You know, there was no ridicule whatever in his attitude, and he was a captain in the Air Force. So they, you know, at the inner levels, they all know because, they've had contact with the ETs themselves. As a matter of fact, military people have been working side by side with aliens for years in these underground bases at Area 51. Mm-hmm. And then George Hall talked about it out in. Charles Hall talked about the tall whites in California. We know that we've been dealing with them at Pine Gap in Australia. So the military knows all about the aliens. There's no hint of ridicule in their attitude. But what they're putting out to the public is, how can you believe in that stuff? See, it's a two-faced situation.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting to think that, cause, you know, I've heard of pilots in the military that have seen things they were told not to talk about it outside of the investigation.
Right.
And I guess it was, you know, especially in later years, perhaps after Project Blue Book, they were discouraged from even reporting it.
Well, of course, they do want the reports, but they want the reports secretly, and they want to keep the information secret. But they do want the reports, so that's why Blue Book had a guy at every single Air Force base in the country, and overseas even.
Because I had never heard of the UFO office before, so I found that interesting as well, because you know we'd all heard about Project Blue Book because there's a lot of information out about that now,
right?
And you know, how they conducted the investigation was kind of a mystery. I guess I'd never thought about it. And that makes absolute sense to hear that they had an actual office with someone assigned to it on the basis.
Absolutely. And Ruppelt, who was in charge of it in the 50s, was a very dedicated and conscientious guy who really wanted to get to the truth. And he had the Battelle Institute in Ohio to put all the information together that was flooding in from all over the country, and they put it on punch cards. At that time, that was high technology in those days. And they put out a special report on the sightings called Special Report 14. And Stanton Friedman was amazed to find that in that Special Report 14, they concluded that I think it was roughly 20 to 30% of the sightings could not be explained by any earthly explanation. And he was shocked, and that meant that they were probably extraterrestrial. So, but it's hard to get your hands on that special report, 14. It's not that easy to get.
Okay, we have another question coming from the virtual auditorium, and that is, do you think that E.T. helped engineer the buildings of antiquity? And do you have a theory of why they may have started in Ireland prior to Egypt?
Well, they might have started what? Again, say that again.
I guess some sort of buildings of antiquity in Ireland. I don't know anything about that one, so I'm going to have to plead ignorance. But do you think they really helped build some of these big monumental buildings and projects that have been built in very ancient times?
I do.
Do you think they had a hand?
Yeah, I do. Machu Picchu, you know, to have built Machu Picchu, a mountain like that, where they would have had to drag those huge boulders up from the valley, would have been virtually impossible with the kind of technology they had then. And why would they
have the wheel?
They didn't even have the wheel.
Metal.
I don't think they had horses even. I don't even think they had horses at that. Why did they put it at the very top of a mountain to begin with? It would make sense if it was a landing place. And B, how did they get all that technology up there? And then you take the Great Pyramid of Giza. I have a whole chapter in my book based on an interview with Robert Bovall. And ultimately, he came to the same conclusion that the aliens had a lot to do with the building of the Great Pyramid. And if you really analyze it, it's the only explanation, because those primitive people in Egypt didn't have that kind of technology to build what they built. So, and there's so many other examples of that Tsoukalos covered in that series that, you know, there's no need for me to go into it.
I recently watched a program about Machu Picchu, and they claimed the reason it was built on top of the mountain was to, because it was, you know, in between these holy mountains, and I'm thinking, it's a lot of work to go to, because I guess most of the construction of Machu Picchu is essentially the foundation, because it required extensive foundation work, as much as 30 feet at the top, to create a foundation that they could even build on.
I know.
That's a lot of work for people who don't even have a wheel.
I know. You know, I don't see how anyone could doubt it, really, especially since we know that they were in Peru anyway, and we know about the plains of Nazca and all of that. Clearly that was alien, that was some kind of an alien facility. And so many myths about the gods coming down from the tops of mountains in history that, you know, it's clear. It's clear to me. I mean, it's logical.
All the way down to that little, I think it's a gold airplane. I know that Giorgio Tsoukalos wears one as a pin.
Oh, yeah.
A replica. You know, where would they get the concept of a little plane? I mean, it's obviously a plane.
All right.
You know, I played with one that looked a lot like that when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's right. No, it was a plane, all right. And the lines of Nazca are a good big clue right there. I don't know whether you ever read Shirley MacLaine's book, Out on a Limb. Did you read that book?
No, actually, I didn't.
I would recommend it.
Well,
I would recommend it, because She found some real evidence that the aliens were in Peru and had been in Peru, and she got exposed to that, and she wrote about it in her book. Quite interesting.
Yeah, you know, we've had some interesting people, and a lot of people really don't think that Tesla was all that. They think that it's mostly hype and mystique around, you know, things like missing notes and so forth and so on, and that he has actually been blamed or given credit for things that he didn't deserve either for. I don't know. You know, I don't know enough about Tesla to say A or nay to those things. Most of what I know is actually probably more popular version of his history than the facts. A person could probably dedicate their life to studying the life of Tesla and not know it all.
Well, first of all, he was the one that came up with alternating current. We've got to give him credit for that. And then, of course, we know that the Tesla coil is the key to electromagnetic power, and that's really what they were using in Germany in the early days, was an adaptation of the Tesla coil, which extracted energy from the atmosphere. So, you know, he was smarter than Edison. I mean, Edison was pushing direct current. Tesla was the one that saw the possibilities of in Niagara Falls and put it to work. I mean, there are a lot of things you've got to give him credit for. You just can't deny it. It's just right looking you in the face. So he has his critics, I know, and of course there are people that are always going to want to put him down. But in my estimation, he was way beyond genius, way beyond genius.
Yeah, it's always. Too bad that most geniuses don't get appropriate credit in their lifetime. And it's true. Whether they're artists or scientists or whatever, they usually aren't recognized for being a genius until they're dead. We only got about 4 minutes till we go to break, so I don't want to get too much in depth into another section of thought, you might say. But sticking with the earlier years with Adamski and Tesla and whatnot, what other, you know, things would you consider really important from that era?
From the 50s?
Pardon?
Are you talking about the 50s?
Yeah.
What era are you talking about? The 50s, right?
Well, just the first half of the first half of the 20th century, you might say.
Well, the first half, we were just talking about World War II was the main interest there, but in the 50s, there were a lot of things going on. Another thing that was going on was science fiction film. Now, that was not an accident. The fact that science fiction film came roaring back in the 50s, at the same time that we were developing anti-gravity technology, that can't be a coincidence. So that's something we can discuss at length if you'd like to, and I have a whole chapter in my book on that.
Sci-fi? Yeah, let's run the sci-fi right now.
It's chapter 12 in my book.
Because science fiction has evolved a great deal in terms of how it's presented on the screen. You know, Star Wars of today, it makes even the first Star Wars movie look a little hokey. So when you look at the science fiction movies from the 50s, they look very hokey and stilted. But, you know, what kinds of ideas do you think were being presented in hopes of perhaps changing the public perception of aliens?
Well, we had George Pal's book, Destination Moon, which was as realistic as it gets, and turned out that the actual moon journey was very much like he showed it in the film. When it happened, so much that was later turned out to be absolutely like the day the Earth stood still. Now that movie, which I think was in 1954, and I talk about it in my book, in which an alien came here to warn us about the use of nuclear weapons, that turned out to be the case, because that's exactly what happened in the meeting with Eisenhower in 1954. That's the exact same scenario, that the aliens that he met with at Edwards Air Force Base in 1954 told him that they would give the United States incredible technology, but that they wanted him to give up nuclear weapons. And after he consulted with the military, they said no. So that turned out to be the exact same story as was presented in The Day the Earth Stood Still. There was a lot in sci-fi film that reflected reality, but of course it was presented as fiction, and everybody viewed it that way. But nevertheless, you know, those ideas did go into the mass subconscious and sort of rooted around in there, and people came to understand what was going on little by little.
Yeah, because when people view something as fictional, it's non-threatening.
Exactly.
So the whole thing is that you can present these ideas in a way that is not going to make people feel as though they're under imminent threat from alien invasions. Because that is something, you know, you hear all the time about how if the masses knew that aliens were visiting, there'd be this mass panic. Do you think that's true? And hang on to those thoughts, because guess what, folks? It is time for us to take a break. While we're away from your computer, check out our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Stay tuned. The Donna Shays will return with our guest, Len Kasten, and more about our topics tonight. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Tia Scott, with our guest, Len Kasten. And once again, I would like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore it, and let me know what you think of the website. There are links that take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. And if you want to go straight to my blog and see what I'm up to, you can go to tiascott.wordpress.com. Now, the subject of extraterrestrials is a fascinating one, and we're fortunate enough to have Len Kasten joining us tonight. So if you would like to ask him a question or make a comment, you can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com, and I'll pass it on from there. If you're listening in on a podcast or think of it after the program is finished, you can go ahead and email me anyhow, and I will do my best to get your questions answered for you. If you're in the virtual auditorium, you can put it into text there, and I'm trying very hard to catch it as the screen scrolls. And if you want to call in, our call-in number is 504-273-7379. Now, Len, we were talking about some of the early years in ufology before we went on break, and one thing that we hadn't talked about at all in regards to that was what is known as Project Serpo, which you talk about in Chapter 7 of your book. You want to tell the audience a little bit about that?
Well, it's quite a fantastic story. In fact, most people can't believe that it's not fictional, because it sounds like fiction, and it's beyond fiction in many ways. The fact that we actually sent 12 American astronauts to a planet 40 light years away on an alien spacecraft in 1965 and kept it secret all these years is an amazing, amazing story, but I'm quite convinced that it happened, and there's so much evidence now that it happened that I don't think there's any question about it. And, of course, Spielberg's movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he did show that departure scene at the end of the movie where the 12 astronauts did board the alien craft. And, of course, the Richard Dreyfuss character was not part of the original story. He was just thrown into the story. But that really happened. The 12 astronauts, 10 men and 2 women, were gone for 13 years. They were on the planet Serpo for 13 years. Two of them died. Actually, it was 3 who died. 1 died on the way, 2 died while they were there, and 2 decided to stay there. So of the 12, only 7 returned. And they returned in 1978. They were debriefed for a full solid year, and an entire 3,000-page book was put together based on that debriefing. They took about 3,000 photographs, all of which, my understanding is, all that material is now stored at Bowling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., in their vaults there. So that really happened as far as I'm concerned. I know other people may think it's fantastic, but the evidence, as far as I'm concerned now, is overwhelming.
And what kind of evidence is there? The Church Auditorium is inquiring about what kind of evidence is there to support that as being fact versus fiction.
The program was overseen by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and in November of 2005, 3 retired officers of the DIA and 3 existing employees came together to form a group of 6 to release the information, the entire story, over the Internet. And they did it by creating a website called www.serpo.org. And they put that information out on that website in the form of 21 emails from somebody who called himself anonymous and claimed to be a retired official of the DIA. But what happened was the website was also became a magnet for all other people who knew about it and who sent in anonymous information and fleshed out the whole story. People who were eyewitnesses to it and who were involved in the training of the astronauts, people who knew the astronauts, people who debriefed the astronauts, they all wrote into that website, and that website has become now the basically the Bible for the whole story. And it's out there. Mm-hmm. It's out there for anybody to look at. www.serpo.org, and these stories all verify the fact that this really happened, and they give different angles of encounters with these people who were involved with it. So,
and has anything been released through the Freedom of Information Act yet in regards to this particular project?
That's a good question, and as far as I know, nothing has, and it would probably be very difficult to pry that information out through the FOIA, because the first thing, of course, that I would want to do, and I'm contemplating it, is try and get my hands on those photographs, because that's the end of the story. That's all we need are the photographs, and plus there are tape recordings that the astronauts made while on Serpo. But probably the most convincing thing of all is the diary of the commander. And Anonymous did release the diary over the Internet, and it's he's telling the story as it happens, and it's quite convincing. So, you know, the information is out there, and I devoted an entire chapter in the book to the story. If it did happen, it's the most amazing story of all in the entire UFO and ET literature, as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh. Now, in regards to these men and women that went to this planet Serpo, which alien race lives on Serpo? Do they look like humans, or, you know, are they, you know, like giant grasshoppers or something?
I know, I've heard about giant grasshoppers too, you know, that's not so
yeah.
close to people. The Serpo, which we, they were named the Ebens. They called them the Ebens, and that name was given to them by MJ-12. It's not a very imaginative name. It just derives from the phrase EBE, which MJ-12 came up with to describe extra biological entities. And so the scientists at Los Alamos named them the Ebens. And they are shorter than us. They're not the Greys. They're not the same as the Greys. They're more human-looking, they have large heads, of course, not too much larger than ours. But they are a distinct race, and they are also, according to Anonymous, they are from the Zeta Reticuli star system. Now, I know some people think that the Greys are from Zeta Reticuli, but I do not think that's the case. I think that the only aliens that are from Zeta Reticuli are the Evens. And so we sent 12 people to their planet, and they lived there for 13 years. Quite a story.
Now, you know, out of these people that went there and then either came back or didn't, you know, you would think that the easiest way to verify the story would be, A, to have the list of names, and B, to find family members who said, yeah, they went away and never came back, or they were gone and then they came back. I mean, surely these people had family and friends.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Here's the story. The 12 people, one of the requirements that the Air Force put out when they first started interviewing people for the job was that they, A, have no friends, no relatives at all. Preferably they'd be orphans. Preferably they have no children. They didn't want anybody with any family connections. And secondly, they were what they call sheep-dipped. Their entire identity was taken away, everything, Social Security, anything that identified them was taken away, and they were given three-digit numbers. And that's how they referred to themselves, was three-digit numbers. In fact, everybody who trained them here before they went there only knew them by their three-digit numbers. They gave each other nicknames. One was called Skipper, another one was called the Doctor, and so forth. But that was one of the requirements, was that they have no connections because they would be gone so long, and that they would be tempted to perhaps tell their stories to their relatives. So the whole thing was very carefully planned, very carefully worked out.
And then you wonder what became of them after they came back. Were they locked away somewhere, never to emerge again?
They came back in 1978, seven of them. They were debriefed for a full year. That would take us to 1979. And then the book was put together then, a 3,000-page book, which Anonymous claims to have access to. In fact, he's been using that book to write the emails. And that's how he had access to the team commander's diary. They didn't live very long after that because they were exposed to a tremendous amount of radiation on Serpo, and it shortened their lives. So the last one died in 2002. And I think that's probably why they started to tell the story, because they were all dead at that point in 2005. And I think that these ex-officials, retired officials of DIA, decided that it was time to get the story out. It was time for people to know about it, and that's what happened.
Well, that's quite interesting, you know, to think about that. These people essentially gave their lives.
Yes,
one way or another.
They did, and they were really a brave bunch of people, and they were incredible pioneers. And when the history book is finally written on this, they will go down, I think, as tremendously brave and courageous people who were willing to do this for their country, to give up their identities, to give up all their connections here, and to live on this planet, which was not hostile. They were very friendly, but nevertheless, they had to live as a military group rather than as civilians while they were on that planet. Quite a story. It's quite a story.
Yeah, it really is. To think about, just the whole idea. I mean, it's not impossible. I mean, when we think about this search for people with no connections, it's been done before. Pony Express was done that way, and so forth and so on.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So, yeah, they looked for orphans because they usually didn't live. Usually died, so, they look for orphans.
Hello?
Yeah, can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can still hear you. Can you hear me okay? Okay.
I hear you just fine. I'm in the middle of a really dramatic thunderstorm, so I've been losing my internet connection and so forth and so on over the last 10 minutes. So if anybody hears loud booms, that's thunder and lightning here. So, yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, it's pretty wild outside sounding right now. I've jumped a few times.
Wow.
It is pretty loud. It's that season, for thunderstorms.
Yeah, all right, that's right. So, let's see, what time is it there now? It's about, 8 o'clock,
8:25? Yeah, we've had them off and on all day today, so it wasn't unexpected. I just hoped that we had a couple of hours without anything. Now, talking about this planet and everything, which I find extremely fascinating, how much, I guess the only source is this website as far as information about it and the people that live there.
Right.
I have to wonder, why did we send 12 people to this planet?
Why we said 12? What's the question?
Yeah, I mean, why did we send anybody there?
Well, the answer to that is very simple. First of all, to give you some background on that story, the Roswell crash, at the Roswell crash site, 4 aliens died in that crash in Roswell, but one survived. He was found hiding behind a rock. And he was taken over by the military, and they took him to Los Alamos Laboratory. And he was, they were from Serpo, although at that time we didn't know the name of the planet. He had a device with him that allowed them to communicate with Serpo. And he showed the scientists how to use it. They had tremendous, tremendous problems with language because their language was very, very difficult for us to understand. We just couldn't get it. But they eventually learned English because they're a lot smarter than we are. That alien was the key to the Serpo story because eventually they got that device working, and we proposed to his planet an exchange program. And he sent that message to Serpo. And that suggestion continued as we gradually worked out the kinks in the communication system. By the time we had them all worked out, it was 1961, and President Kennedy was in office. And Kennedy found out about it. He was briefed on it, and it was he was the one that made the decision. He said that he wanted to do an exchange program, and that's really that was the key. It was Kennedy that put it in motion.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
And you know that he was also very interested in the moon trip, but he couldn't talk about this trip. It was just too secret, much too
right.
secret.
So has there been any further contact with Serpo that you are aware of?
Yeah, they've been back 9 times since. The last one was in November of, they've been here 9 times. The last one was in November of 2009. They landed at a remote island in the Central Pacific called Johnston Island, which is really about the size of an aircraft carrier. We had their representatives there from China and from the Vatican, as well as U.S. Officials. So we have really established...
Why China and the Vatican?
I don't know who makes all I can tell you. Is that according to the Serpo website, which you can go out and check out yourself. They were at that particular meeting in November of 2009, we did invite other nations to participate, and China was one of them, and the Vatican was one of them. We have established basically a working relationship with them. We've ironed out all the communications problems. Now we understand how to, and we've gotten a tremendous amount of technology from them, because don't forget, they had the ability to get here. And you know damn well we wanted to get our hands on that technology one way or the other.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I could definitely understand that. So we've got this going on, and, the next question is going to be, we undoubtedly have other contact going on, and one of the big rumors in the modern era is that the entire Iraqi war is actually based on the American military seeking access to a Stargate.
Right. And I do have a chapter on that. That whole chapter was taken from an interview with Michael Sala. I don't know if you know about Michael or not. Have you had him on your show?
I don't think I've had him on my show, but I've met him and talked with him at conferences and whatnot.
Well, we have Michael to thank for the whole movement in exopolitics, because he started it. And his book, Exopolitics, was a breakthrough book. And that was based on articles that he wrote on his website way back in the early 90s, I believe. Anyway, this theory that we invaded Iraq to get our hands on that Stargate, he was the one that came up with that. And when I interviewed him, he convinced me that was indeed the case. And he's convinced of it. And it does make sense if you really study what happened at that point. The fact that we became to believe that there was a Stargate there in the city of Uruk, U-R-U-K, which is in central Iraq, which was an ancient city in Mesopotamia, or Babylon. And do you know about William Henry? Have you ever discussed anything with William Henry?
I've not talked with William Henry. I know a little bit about him, but I haven't actually talked with him.
Well, Henry says that these ancient Sumerian tablets do show the entities going through the Stargate. And if you recall the story of the Iraqi invasion, the museum in Baghdad was left unprotected for four days, and it was looted, systematically looted. And one of the things that was taken from the museum were these 6,000-year-old clay tablets called cylinder seals, many of which showed the use of the Stargate. So the question is, well, why did the Marines stand down and let this looting take place of one of the most valuable museums in the entire planet? Why would they do that? And then, of course, the answer is very simple. They didn't do it. We did. We were the ones that looted it. And the reason was to get our hands on those tablets and understand how to use the Stargate. And so that was Michael Sala's theory, and I do think it stands up under scrutiny. I think he's right about it. Of course, you know, Sitchin talked about those tablets as well. So, and so did William Henry, the so-called cylinder seals.
Yeah, you know, I've obviously seen the Stargate in the Hollywood version, but what exactly use would this Stargate be for people? The military in particular.
Have you had Andrew Bisaccio on your show yet?
No.
Haven't had him on, okay.
No.
He talks about being teleported through a Stargate. He talks about it. He claims that he himself was teleported through a Stargate. So, Hollywood really in a way does reflect what's going on. The question is, when they present it as fiction, they take actual events and actual technology, and they just present it as fiction. Everyone walks away thinking it's fiction, but it's based on reality. And a lot of people have talked about the fact that we do have Stargate technology. It does exist. That is to say, we can walk through a door and literally be teleported across the galaxy. How this works exactly, I don't know. But it's out there. The information is out there. In fact, many people have talked about it. So if the U.S. came to understand that there was indeed an ancient Stargate from Babylon that existed in Iraq, they would definitely want to get their hands on it, wouldn't you say? Are we gonna let Saddam Hussein keep that and perhaps use it and who knows what? You know, I think that was the reason for the urgency, was not the oil. It wasn't the oil. It was to get control of that before anyone else could. And one of the things that I think we were concerned about was the fact that the Germans, the Russians, and the French were doing archaeological work there with Saddam Hussein, and I think probably we were concerned that somebody else would get it before we would. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we did indeed get it. Whether or not we've used it or even learned how to use it, I don't know, because it's not something that can be that people can use easily. According to Sala and others, you really have to go through about 5 years of consciousness training before you can even use it, expanding your consciousness. So what use it's been, I don't know. There's plenty of information now about the fact that the U.S. military does have Stargate technology. And I personally am quite convinced of it. And some people think
I was just thinking that's really fascinating to think about the possibility. I mean, I've even heard stories about, I guess it would be something similar that existed in pre-Columbian Americas, that certain people were able to travel clear across the continent in virtually no time.
Now, was that Mayan? Was that the Mayans, or which group was that?
It's usually, referring to some ancient group before the Mayans or before the Incas, before any of them. So it could be a mythological group. I'm not sure who exactly it'd be referring to.
Where did you get that information from?
Just from stories that I was told, having lived, in the Southwest and whatnot. The first stories I was told were from Native Americans about, in a form of like a legend or a story. And, I just found that, it intrigued me. As a young adult, it was like, ooh, that's kind of cool. And then I read someplace stories of early Catholic priests that said that there were stories of particular individuals that would be seen, someplace in the morning, and later that day they'd be seen hundreds of miles away, and there was no way they could have been the same place on the same day, or in those two places on the same day, because of the distance. And
so
after
the Spanish invasion?
So, I always found that an intriguing story. Now, whether it's true or not, I don't know. But it is an intriguing story.
Well, these cylinder seals do show individuals walking through a gate. And the technology does exist. I'm quite convinced of it. I think the Mayans may have had some connection with it. I'm not sure. It would explain a lot about their civilization.
Yeah, I mean, they had these huge trade routes, where they know they were trading macaws and food stuff and seeds and technology and and all sorts of things.
Right.
And, you know, carrying it on long distances where they had no pack animal except a dog and no wheel, and you either carried it on your back or in your hand.
Right, exactly. And Cortez encountered these beautiful objects made of gold. I mean, huge objects, like a huge golden wheel, and yet they had no gold mines. There were no gold mines they could find anywhere. So where'd they come
from?
Yeah,
and they were in search of that gold.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think the Stargates have been around for a long time, and I think a lot of people do know how to use them. And
it would be interesting to find out. You know, for sure. I'd love to see such a thing. You know, it would be really interesting to be able to.
You should get Andrew Basiago on your show. Basiago. I think you'll find his story to be incredible, and your listeners, I think, will really be incredible about what he has to say.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it definitely, you know, I'll have to check him out because it sounds like he would be somebody. You know, and moving on forward through your book, though, you know, besides the Stargate connection with Iraq, what other, you know, like we have the anti-gravity machine engineering in terms of space travel and whatnot. I know you talked about it in your book. You want to talk about it a little bit with the audience?
I think that we've had anti-gravity technology now since, we've had it working since the 80s, but the development began in the 50s. Some of it was through the German scientists that came over here. A lot of them were ex-Nazis, through Project Paperclip. Have you heard of that?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have.
We repatriated a lot of the Nazis, cleaned up their records, and put them to work in aerospace companies here in America. And many of them knew about the anti-gravity technology that they had developed in Germany. So we had that. According to an article in Popular Mechanics, I think it was, in the 50s, there were 47 universities working on anti-gravity technology in America in the 50s. And
wow.
Yeah, yeah. And the B-2 bomber clearly does have anti-gravity technology built into it. In my book, I talk about an interview with Paul LaViolette, a physicist. He wrote a book called Anti-Gravity Propulsion, and it's all in there, too. So the fact that these planes can fly around the world without refueling, it really is the ultimate weapon, and we've had it since the 80s. So that in itself may explain why we won the Cold War, if for no other reason.
Uh huh. Yeah. It. Do they not? I mean, what kind of fuel would they be using? I mean, is it just extremely efficient? Are they using an alternative fuel? Do you know?
It has to do with charging with electricity. In other words, electromagnetism is powering these craft, these saucers. It's all electrical. The only question is, how do they generate the electricity? That's the only key. And according to Robert Lazar, who worked on this at the Area 51, the aliens were using antimatter. But Tesla's solved the problem using the so-called Tesla coil, and that's how the German UFOs were powered. It has to do with electromagnetism. This is where the power is coming from, and
yeah.
It requires the generation of huge amounts of electricity, you know, millions of volts, in order to make this work. So the question is, how do you generate that kind of electricity? And
yeah.
That's what it's all about. How they do it, I'm not exactly clear, but I do have some information about it in my book.
Yeah, I'd hate to think that they're flying around with little nuclear reactors. I mean, we've all seen
I think in the early days they were using nuclear, yeah. But I don't think they're using nuclear anymore. They're using what they call warp drives now and pulse drives. And we've got craft that can go to the moon now and Mars very, very quickly. And it's all top secret, of course, but they're way beyond anti-gravity now. Anti-gravity is what they use in our atmosphere. But once they get out of into outer space, they use a whole different system. Of course, gravity doesn't exist in space, though, so they don't have to worry about it.
Right. So I guess you would have to create an artificial one. I don't know. I have to admit all of that's a little bit beyond my ability to comprehend. I still describe an internal combustion motor as being magic. Well, to me, it's quite simple. You have a magic talisman, and you have magic potions, and you give it the right magic potions, and you use your magic talisman, and it moves. And if you don't have enough potions, it won't go. If you lose your talisman, it won't go.
I think if you were to plunk down an automobile in the Mayan times, they would have considered it magic. Of course, they would have said it was magical. There's a thin line between technology and magic, actually, I think.
Well, you know, if you're not mechanically inclined, okay, you know, yes, I understand the basic theory of an internal combustion motor, but, you know, it's one thing to understand that there's little micro explosions going on in things called pistons and cylinders, and it's another to make one work. So it's, for me, it's much easier to describe it as magic. It's all
that's
magic.
As good an explanation.
Magic talisman is the key.
Yeah, that's as good an explanation as any, actually.
Yeah,
sure,
you know, it's much more applicable in my case because I'm really inept with the motor. You know, my common description is broke, don't go. You know, yeah, it either goes or it doesn't, and that's all I know.
You're still having problems with the mysteries of the internal combustion engine then, huh? You got a long way to go to get the gravity.
Yeah, I don't even pretend to understand the concepts of anti-gravity or electromagnetic engines we're dealing with bicycle level technology being a challenge, okay? I have a big, thick book for my bicycle. I'll admit that I'm technology challenged or mechanically challenged. I can manage computers quite well. But the internal combustion engine's a mystery.
Yeah, well,
I think
because
it's got so many parts, and they're all greasy, and, yeah. Even scarier is I'm a car dealer's daughter. I grew up in the shop.
Oh, God, really?
And I'm still clueless. It was, you know, people look at me funny, and I say, I never even changed a tire until I was in my late 20s. Never changed a tire until I was in my late 20s. First time, it was in the middle of the night on a dirt road.
Oh, really?
Now, I understand theory, but it's another between, like I said, there's a big gap between theory and doing it. It's not the same when you're, you know, on a hill, on a dirt road, and it's dark, and it was in Arizona, so, you know, nighttime meant snakes are active.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'll never forget the experience. I was thrilled. I'd had a tire slashed by a rock, and there was no driving on it.
What road were you on?
I was on a dirt road going home. Dirt road going home. I was on my way home from work that night. And a rock, there was a lot of sandstone in the area and limestone. And it's very, in northern Arizona, the limestone is incredibly sharp.
Oh, right.
Or it can be. And it sliced literally the inner sidewall on the tire.
Wow.
On a brand new tire. The tire was less than a week old.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, thank goodness for road hazard warranties on your tires because that time paid for the tire. And,
where were you? What city were you near? Prescott? Was it in Prescott?
Or? No, I was near Winslow, Arizona.
Oh, Winslow. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So
you know, even the
pardon?
Even the internal combustion engine is ancient technology now. Actually, it really is compared to where we are. The true state of science today is so far beyond what they're telling us that you would think it's magic. Actually, they're like 50 years ahead in secret of where we think we are today. So, don't feel bad that you don't understand the internal combustion engine because you don't have to anymore.
Well, I find it a little hard to believe. As smart as we are and as many advances as we've made, I mean, my great-grandparents went from literally horse and buggy travel to a man landing on the moon during their lifetime alone.
Right.
You know, in my lifetime, I've seen us go from computers took up an entire building to I could put one in my purse.
Exactly.
That is fully functional and take it with me and connect to the internet anywhere.
I was in on the early days of computer developments, and they did indeed take up whole rooms, and the whole room had to be completely air-conditioned. It was unbelievable. And now they've got them on the head of a pin. Yeah, exactly.
Even 10 years ago, if anybody had told me, because I've actually done this, taking my computer with me, and I've connected to the internet when I'm camping in the middle of the forest, and I don't even have electricity. I've done it at the beach. I've done it going down the highway. Not while I'm driving, okay? Folks, I was not driving while I was simultaneously using my computer. You know, so the thing is that, you know, I wouldn't have believed it 10 years ago that I could do that. Now that's like, so what? That's no big deal.
It's no big deal. In fact, we've already gone way beyond that into remote viewing and telepathy. So we're way beyond that already. Are you ready for that? You know?
Yeah, well, the whole remote viewing thing I find intriguing because of the fact that, you know, it smacks of the paranormal. And yet, it's common knowledge the military, both in the United States and Russia, probably as other countries as well, had extensive programs using it during the height of the Cold War.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're still using it, of course. It works.
Well,
you know,
they claim that they don't, but, you know,
The military is very pragmatic. If it works, they're going to use it. They don't care what it is. You know, if it works, they'll use it, and it works. Have you talked to Ed Dames? Do you know about Ed Dames?
I have heard him on other programs. I've not personally talked to him myself, no. But, yeah, he has lots of interesting things to say. Often, remote viewing, I know people that have done it by accident and then verified the things that they saw by going, what in the world did I see, and started looking for it. So, you know, it's not something that can only be done in a controlled environment. Now, I know that, I believe it was Ed Dames that said that this is not a psychic event. This is something that anybody can do.
Right, and anybody can do it. It's great. It's a human capability, and it's just a matter of developing it. You don't have to be particularly smart either. So we're in for a whole new era now. We're on the brink, I think, of a whole new era that's going to be one. I have a chapter in my book called Man and Superman, in which I talk about the development, how we're developing superhuman capabilities. And I also talk about it in Chapter 21, Psychic Discoveries, and also 22 about time travel. I think all these things are now, we're on the brink of all of these things. It's unbelievable what's around the corner now.
So do you see humans essentially evolving into something bigger, better than we were a century ago?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's all a matter of consciousness, and consciousness is expanding.
And this has been going on with me for decades. I'll go sit and people watch. There's nothing better than sitting in a mall at Christmas time and watching with people. And as you watch the people, I find myself mentally sorting them into people, not people. I don't know who the people are versus the non-people or what the difference is. But on some level, I'm perceiving a difference. Most are not people, and then there's this smaller group of people, maybe 30% are, you know, this other group. And I'm like, what is the difference? And what am I noticing? Because, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with age or the way they're dressed or the gender or anything. I can't find any similarities when I'm looking at it and I'm doing this mental sorting thing. So what am I perceiving that is different about a third of the population?
What conclusions have you come to?
That I have no idea what the difference is. It has to be something intangible that I instinctively notice. But what that intangible is completely a mystery. I mean, I've seen them with mohawks, and I've seen them in suits, and everything in between. So it's not anything that you
What is the difference that you're noticing? What is the difference? Can you describe it?
I mentally tag them. That's a person. That's a not people. I don't know
Sorry, which is the 30%? The people or the not people?
The people. The people are the 30%, the smaller group.
And the others are not people.
Not people. Yeah, and why those designations? I don't know where they come from. And it's just one of those, you know, things that make you doubt your own sanity sometimes. I'm like, well, why is that one different? And it might be one of a group, or it might be an entire group is one or the other. There's no rhyme or reason that I can figure out.
Well, I think there is. I think you should be more. You should have more confidence in what you're noticing, because I think there's something to it. And some other people have noticed that, too. So you're not alone. Don't think you're crazy.
Well, I know that other people have said the same thing. Yeah, you're right. Because I can remember telling my mother, like 20 years ago, I think we're about to split into two species. And she'd look at me like I was kind of demented, you know. But that's my general opinion, is that we are about to split into two different species.
Well, I
we
think...
We maybe physically not... appear the same.
Do you think that it has something to do with the soul?
I don't know. You know, like I said, I'm not sure what I'm perceiving or how I'm perceiving it.
Well,
but there is a difference.
I think you're onto something. I agree with you. And I think that, the Bible says that we will eventually be split into the sheep and the goats. So maybe what you're getting an advanced view of that.
It's better to be a sheep or a goat.
Which would you prefer to be? Yeah. I don't think you'd want to be a sheep, would you?
Well, yeah, sheep aren't exactly the brightest creatures on earth, but at the same time, have you ever spent any time with goats?
No, I haven't.
Male goats smell real bad, and some of their habits to attract the females are really repulsive. And they smell real bad. It's real hard if you have to handle a male goat to wash them. It was so bad that I asked the veterinarian if they could be de-scented, and he said yes, they could, but it's called castration, and then the females aren't real interested in them anymore. Yeah, the male goats stink. There's no other way to put it. They stink. Yeah.
But I think in the Bible it was strictly a metaphor. I don't think they were talking about real
sheep. I hope so.
Take the characteristics of sheep, who are basically followers and placid followers and don't come up with anything, whereas these goats can climb mountains, you know? So maybe they were trying to tell us something from those characteristics. I don't know.
Or they were two familiar animals, and they were similar but different, and it was close enough for an analogy.
Right.
They're very not that different in appearance. I mean, especially if you have what's known as a woolless sheep, like the Gulf Coast sheep, doesn't have wool. Oh, it's very similar to a goat. If you're not familiar with them, you'd probably think it was a goat, not realizing it was actually a sheep.
I do make a point of saying that the human race has been sheep-like for a long time. In fact, in the introduction to my book, I talk about that. I think the time is coming now where we're not going to be sheep anymore. And things are going to change. So maybe that's what you're seeing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It could be. But guess what? We are out of time. So you want to tell everybody how to find your website real quick?
Yeah, yeah. It's www.et-secrethistory.com. And out there you'll find a lot more information, and you can order the book right through the website. So thank you very much.
Folks.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure, Gia. Thank you.
I want to thank you for joining us tonight. You've been a fantastic guest, and it's been very, very interesting. We could have done 4 hours, I think. Folks, I've enjoyed the program with Len very much tonight, and I hope all of you have as well, and that you found it provided you all with plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next Tuesday, and we'll bring you along for another episode of The Dawn of Shades, as we're joined by a very special guest. And I know it's sure to be another fascinating conversation for everyone as well. With that, we're out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
Good night, Gia. Thank you.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith.